Welcome to the Making Your Miles Count podcast. Today we're going to be talking about cash flow, one of the most important things in business and personal life as well. Many people think cash flow is an extremely complex thing. Sometimes in highly complex businesses it is, but in general it actually is not nearly as complicated as most people think. One of the best stories I've ever heard in my 30 plus years in the industry came about 25 years ago, where I was doing some consulting at a trucking firm. And during a break, one of the assistants came to me and asked whether I wanted to hear a story. And this is the story that she told me. A number of years prior to that, they hired a driver to go from one general location to another general location. And it was a very easy job. It wasn't pin to pin, but it was, you know, half a dozen shippers, receivers on one end, half a dozen shipper receivers on the other end, and it's basically going back and forth. A very mindless, so to speak, job description. And they hired the individual. There was a few things that they were a little bit concerned about. He didn't come across very bright, but he had a great resume and he'd good driving experience and the like. And so they figured they'd give him a chance. They put him into one of their company trucks and off and rolling. Approximately 2 years later, that same driver was asked to come into the payroll department. And he goes to the payroll. Now, a few things about this guy. I already said he was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But he also was a little, how do I say this? He probably should have taken about two more showers in a week than he was used to. And so he's a little bit of a recluse scraggly looking and the like. But for the job that he was doing back and forth, it was really good. But just from a social perspective, actually a little bit lower than normal. The payroll department says, "Hey, thank you for coming. I have a concern here." And says, what's the problem? He says, "We've been giving you checks for the last 2 years, and we have noticed that a lot of the checks have not been cashed. Some of the oldest checks are just approaching the six-month mark, and then they're going to be stale dated and can't be cashed." And the driver goes, "Oh my goodness." And I says, "I have the checks." And the guy says, "Really, what, explain yourself." So he pulls out his wallet and he opens up his wallet. And there he has about a dozen or so checks. This is good 30 plus years ago. So he's getting physical checks, not direct deposit. And he says, "Yeah, here's the ones that I haven't cashed." And she goes, "Why aren't you cashing them?" And he says, "Well, whenever I need money, I cash a check. And so then I wait, and then sometimes I wait so long, and all of a sudden I get another paycheck and I put it behind the other one. And that's how I've been managing my cash for the last 2 years." The payroll person says, "Oh my goodness, you know, excellent and stuff like this, but maybe what we should do is set you up with, number one is automatic deposit." I guess it was just right in that time where automatic deposits were becoming popular. "And then also, we can inform the bank that you can put this into a savings account so that you can at least gain interest rather than have the checks in your checking account." And the guy goes, "Okay, is that a good idea?" And she said, "Yes, it is a very good idea, and you can save and collect interest on it." That story is probably one of the best stories from a financial management perspective that anybody can understand. First of all, it was 2 years from the time that he hired to the time he was brought into the payroll department. And to have 6 months worth of outstanding paychecks means he is putting aside 25% of his paycheck. Put into context that this individual probably would be rated somewhere between 90-95 IQ, so he's below average, where average is 100. You do not have to be a genius to be an extremely good financial manager. In fact, if you take a look at history and you take a look at different demographics, there's a demographic that's actually very funny. This actually came from about 40, 50 years ago, before the internet. The research was there was three categories. They took a look at a whole bunch of different industries, you know, engineering, truck driving, doctors, lawyers, teachers, all sorts. And they found that right near the bottom of terrible money managers, there were three industries that were very close to the bottom, not the bottom, I guess, but they were almost identical. The first one was professors, like university professors. So they were extremely low in their financial management acumen, I guess. The second one, and this is going to be controversial no matter how you look at it, were religious leaders, like pastors or priests. They were in the same category. And the third one, prostitutes. I don't know whether this was a true reflection of an actual report or not, but I think it's hilarious. Anyway, I do know from my experience, I have an MBA in financial management. So I have a fair bit of degrees behind my name. And when it comes to actual financial management, if I was managing my own truck, which historically I have, the education that I got assists in managing the cash for a highway tractor almost zero. It's not an intellectual thing when it comes to financial management. It's way more an emotional thing, but probably the biggest thing has to do with structure and discipline. That truck driver who is 90, 95 IQ, he had high structure and he had high discipline. If that was good 35, maybe 40 years ago, that guy, if nothing else changed, he is a multi-millionaire and he has that low of an IQ. Jordan Peterson made a phenomenal statement once in one of his lectures. He says, there is no correlation between smart and wise. A person can be extremely smart, highly educated, but unbelievably foolish. So when we think about cash flow, managing the cash for your truck and your family, don't knee-jerk reaction and think, I'm just not smart enough. Actually, I personally have been in the industry as many years as I can. The more smart people are, the worse of managers they actually become. I hope to be just an average IQ person, because that's really, that's all you need to be successful in life. And realistically, if you are just an average IQ person and you know and you accept that you're average IQ, you are not susceptible for some of the scams and for some of the trickery that's out there for financial management. Really, you have to be simple, disciplined, structured. That's all you really need to be a great financial manager. Several months ago now, I had a client come into my office and sit on the other side of my desk and start explaining to me the predicament that he was in. And he had a $6,000 or $7,000 maintenance bill, and they only had like $1,000 left on their line of credit. And so I asked, my first question was, when did you start to panic? And he said, well, about a week ago when I realized that my line of credit wasn't enough to pay for the bill. And I said, why did you wait so long? I says, you should have been panicking way before this. After viewing his financial situation, they have a line of credit. They also had several credit cards, and there was other bills that were outstanding as well. And I said, you have, I think it was a $10,000 line of credit. And I said, when you started going into the line of credit, did you think about panicking? And apparently not. But there are different owner operators out there. Some people would panic when they started going into the line of credit. Other people, they have a savings account. They go up to, say, let's say they have $20,000. As soon as they get below $20,000, that's when they start panicking. Others, $30,000. It all comes down to, when are you panicking? And realistically, we go through phases where we feel that we're doing okay, and then there's other times where we're panicking. And it all depends on what we understand about our financial situation and where we have needled ourselves to panic. The individual should never have started to panic so close to the end. And that is one of the key areas in financial management, and that is, where do we place our panic? The vast majority of all owner-operators that have ever signed up to own a truck are grossly undercapitalized, which means they've borrowed almost everything for everything. And for them to get to a place where they don't have to panic, generally should be 2-3 years, depending on how much their original debt on their truck is, maybe. If they don't have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in a savings account, if they don't have that, they should be panicking. And that's the biggest problem. When do you tell yourself to panic? When you decide to panic is a conscious choice in your mind. And that has to do with your belief or your understanding or your willingness to sacrifice for the future. It's called delayed gratification. That point of delayed gratification is different for every person. Some people have a high degree of tolerance for delayed gratification. Others have a very low degree of tolerance. In 1960s, a psychologist by the name of Walter Mischel, PhD, conducted the now famous marshmallow test on young children, in which they would take a child into a room and on a plate put a marshmallow, and the individual would say, "Now, I'll be back in 15 minutes, a little bit of time, whatever the time was, and if the marshmallow is not eaten, you get another marshmallow so you can enjoy two marshmallows. No problem, if you want to eat the marshmallow, you can eat the marshmallow, but then you don't get the second one when I get back." And then the tester would leave the room, and the cameras would be watching these poor children struggling to decide, should I eat the marshmallow or should I just wait, delayed gratification, to get two marshmallows? There's a lot of these tests have been done. Some of the greatest things, look on YouTube, some of them are just hilarious. But realistically, they found in the 1960s about 67% of all children would eat the marshmallow, and only about a third of them would not. And the ones who were not eating them, generally they were disproportionately represented by wealthy people, whereas the 67% who ate them and did not express delayed gratification were disproportionately poor in the study. And realistically, all that really says is that you can train individuals to hold delayed gratification in their life. It's something that is trained by society, that is trained by parents, by your friends, those who influence you. Whoever you're listening to, if they practice delayed gratification, chances are it's going to influence you more. You're going to be less inclined to eat life's marshmallows. So realistically, a big factor of cash flow management is what you're thinking about yourself, those around you, and your support group for thinking delayed gratification. Because realistically, if virtually all owner-operators out there are undercapitalized, they need to put money aside. That is, they need to be in panic mode, delayed gratification mode, for as long as it takes until they truly are in a safe place financially. And that is the real conflict in individuals. Can you embrace delayed gratification? Do you have the support structure around you, your spouse, your friends, those you listen to on YouTube or podcasts, or like, are those the kind who will support you in saying, you know what, I'm not going to Cancun, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that, I'm not getting the chrome, I'm not doing whatever, because I need to save up enough money? Or are you the kind of person who has surrounding you individuals who go out and buy 3/4 tons and bass boats and cottages and all sorts of debt up to their eyeballs, and then all of a sudden they're in a little bit of a pickle, and now they're panicking, and suddenly they have real stress in their life. If you want to be a great financial manager for your business as well as personal, you have to embrace delayed gratification. And you have to embrace it to the point where you are over the hump. And you know that no matter what comes along, you're going to be okay. I'm going to give you an illustration on this. And this is the reason why we're in our audition today. And I got my wood stove here and my wood behind you. Use the illustration of our wood stove. My wife and I, in our place, we heat our home. The backup is electric, but we have wood stove. It gives great heat in the wintertime. The smell, even the responsibility, first thing in the morning you get up and you start this fire. We actually have two wood stoves, and you start this fire and you go to that fire and then you go back to this one and stir it. But it takes us a good 45 minutes before things are all up and burning well, kind of a thing. We enjoy that practice. We enjoy that activity. It's rustic maybe, but it's also, for us, it's very enjoyable. Do we save money? A little bit, but really not all that much. We live on 80 acres and we get 4 to sometimes as much as 8 cords of wood of deadfall during the year. So we can cut it up and we have our own firewood if we want. But the type of wood that is around on our property is primarily poplar. And poplar burns cold and it's hard to start sometimes and stuff. So we oftentimes get loads of pine. Here's our wood stove, and I got some wood in front of the wood stove. And so when it gets cold outside, I just throw it up and it's good. This will probably do for maybe an hour or two. And but the box behind me, that will last for approximately, very low of 5 days to as much as a week and a half. But then once that box is empty, then I wheel it over to our deck, and I have a box of wood on the deck. And that box holds approximately 1.5 to 2.5 weeks, depending on how cold it is outside. And so I can move that box a couple of times before that one is empty. Then when the deck wood box is empty, I go out to our one of our sea cans. And in our sea can, I have generally 8 to 10 cords of wood cut and stacked in there. And almost always we have those 8 to 10 cords ready around, could be anywhere from September all the way to November, depending on when I get the wood and cut it up and split it and then stack it. It takes anywhere from a few weeks to sometimes on and off a few months to get it all cut and stacked. But bit by bit, every couple of weeks or a week or two, I bring in a load of wood to fill up my deck box, all the time slowly burning what I have here in this box. That system of reserve, wood reserve, allows me two things. Number one, I don't worry when a freezing cold 40 below blizzard comes along and nothing can move anywhere for 4 or 5 days, or even 2 weeks for that matter. In a 2 week period, I may have to empty my deck box. I may have to go out into the sea can and bring a load of wood to my deck box, but I have enough wood for everything. Imagine, if you will, I have all the wood out in my bush here, and I would have to go out every single day, cut down a tree, cut it up into logs, split it, and then bring it inside and then burn it. Well, first of all, if it was green wood, it wouldn't burn very well. And second of all, but even if it was standing dead tree and it would be dry, there is little time between the work that I need in the bush and the time I burn it. That is a dangerous time. I have no flexibility of doing something else. I can't take advantage of things. It is a high, super high priority, and that's pressure. That is panic, and that's what you don't want when you are dealing with cash. You don't want to be so close to your line of credit that you are going to implode, you're going to crash, you're going to have damages, because that's when you start overpaying for things, that's when you stop being able to work, and your life starts to collapse. That is a concept of reserve. I grew up in a very financially conservative family, but I was never really taught a reserve fund. I was taught efficiency, but not a reserve fund. I'm a natural saver, but I'm also a natural, I guess, a spender or investor as well. I had very little reserve. And the bigger our firm got, for instance, I needed larger and larger reserves. That was not natural for me. I don't like to see, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 just sitting there doing nothing, waiting for an emergency. And it's the same thing, I'm sure, with yourself. If you own a truck, to sit there and watch a $30,000 or $40,000 savings account just sitting there doing nothing, and you're supposed to panic until you get to 50. That's your number. You have constant doubt. Well, why am I panicking? I have 42,000 in my account. Why should I panic for another $8,000? Those are both natural and unnatural thoughts that come into our mind. But in the end, it comes down to your determination as to how professional you want to manage your business. If you want to tailgate the truck ahead of you, the truck ahead of you is your revenue and your expenses are 4 feet and you're going 60 miles an hour. All that truck has to do is tap on his brakes and instantly you have an accident. If you want to live your life like that, I suggest not being an independent operator, because you're just going to go from crisis to crisis to crisis, and 5-10 years later you're going to say this is nothing but total chaos. In the end, it comes down to sacrifice. You sacrifice in panic until you have the right reserve. I can buy cheap pine firewood, 8-foot lengths, in the spring or summer, and I can store it all and work it all, put it all away, and when September, October, November comes along, I no longer have to worry at all about anything about firewood. I'm heating for the winter, and there is no pressure. And realistically, that's the picture you want in your life. You don't want to worry about money, because you want to be able to say, wait a minute, Maybe I'm getting these maintenance, and this is a big thing that accountants get all the time. But truck's a lemon, the pressure of these maintenance bills, and you look at the maintenance bills, and you know what? They're actually reasonable, but people are panicking because they're so close to not having enough for anything, and that pressure and that panic is convincing them, I got to get something that doesn't have the maintenance. When realistically, your maintenance is fine, but you're just tailgating far too closely. You gotta sacrifice and work like crazy, panic until you have such a reserve that you can objectively look at your maintenance and go, yeah, you know, I did spend $15,000 there, but you know what? I look in there, it actually makes sense. It's within budget, maybe a little bit high, but considering everything else that's out there, you know what? I think that's okay. I'm gonna keep on doing it. You don't have to worry about it. You can make objective, good, solid choices and decisions based on facts.
Subscribing to this channel provides you regular access to professional advice on independent operators. If you want to support us, like, share, and turn on that notification.
Thanks for stopping by Making Your Miles Count. For further Making Your Miles Count productions, call us at 877-987-9787 or download us at makingyourmilescount.com.